All right. Good morning, everybody. I welcome you to a beautiful but chilly Kentucky morning. It's the typical Kentucky days that I've gotten to know over the last few years, where one week it's 70 degrees and the next week we have snow flurries. But we're here, we're excited, and we're looking forward to the second day of presentations and panels, and it's gonna be a lot of fun. And I'm gonna relinquish right away to Leanne.
Okay, nice to see you all this morning. Thought we had a great day yesterday, and not to put any pressure on our speakers, but let's go for it, people.
Why are we being punished?
So our fourth session, I have this problem. This fourth session, the search for a usable past, POW memory and politics. And our first paper giver is Joseph Miller, an assistant professor of military science and a doctoral candidate in the Department of History at the University of Maine, Orono. His dissertation topic is The Men Were Sick of the Place, Illness and Environment in the War of 1812. He has published several peer review articles and book chapters, the most recent being The Human Landscape of War, published in Military Psychology, Concepts, Trends, and Interventions by Sage in 2015. He also publishes in Military Trade Publications and writes trauma memoir. And the title of his paper today is Prisoner of War Memoirs of the War of 1812, Windows into Early 19th Century Trauma. Angela Riotto, sitting next to him, is a doctoral candidate at the University of Akron. Her dissertation is entitled Beyond the Scrawled, Worn Slips of Paper, Union and Confederate Prisoners of War and Their Post-War Memories. She is the author of several book chapters, the most recent being Defending Our Suffering, Union and Confederate Ex-Prisoners of War and Their Post-War Publications, to be published in Enduring War, New Perspectives on Civil War Veteranhood, forthcoming from LSU. Her paper today is entitled As Bad as Any, Confederate Ex-Prisoners and Their Captivity Narratives, 1865 to 1890. And finally, at the end, we have Douglas Gardner, a lecturer and coordinator of the history program at Indiana University, Purdue University, Columbus, otherwise known as IUPUC. Right, Douglas?
You have to agree
with Doug.
We had to have a conversation about that. It was not easy for me to get all those words together. His most recent publication is An Inscrutable Result, The Historiography of the Election of 1860, in the Election of 1860 Reconsidered, published by Kent State University Press. And today, he will speak on Raiders and Regulators, Masculinity, Social Class, Westernness, and Food in Andersonville POW Narratives. So, take it away, Joe.
So first of all, I want to thank the conference organizers. This has been a really enjoyable experience, and a lot of times conferences are high-pressure events, and the collegial atmosphere, I've really enjoyed it thus far. So I'm going to differentiate from the mode that most people have gone through, because I submitted a full article-length paper, and I could never read it off. So I want to basically talk about a couple of things, points that I'd want to make, and a couple significant things about my argument and the place where I was at in research, what led me to this topic. So the moment where I decided to really pay attention to the POW experience is not something that made it into the paper. Actually, I'm at an archive, I'm there to work, I don't necessarily enjoy it and things like that, but I have these moments where I notice these weird things or these sort of awful things or just these things that are exceptional. And I was reading the Lewis Bond Journal, and there was this story that was just so ridiculous, and it was so, I did not believe it, and I still don't, and that's why I'd never write it. But it has everything to do with the captive experience and the heightened fear of Native Americans that happened and U.S. captivity in the War of 1812. So he's describing a Native American person who I don't believe existed, but I'll use his description, where this member of the militia, Michigan militia, who's turncoated and is Native American, comes back from out in the wilderness, and he goes to a woman, and he throws something at the woman, and she's ashen and white and passes out. And he says, "Make me a soup," and it's revealed that it was a human foot. And the story is so ridiculous, and I don't believe it. But this experience of captivity and heightened fear of Native American, and I don't want to call it racism yet, because, you know, Spencer doesn't, you know, the social Darwinism isn't really a thing yet, but this really elevated fear of Native Americans that happens for soldiers when they're captured. The other thing about it is my dissertation, one of the things I'm really trying to do in my dissertation is taking the war and wars out of that battle narrative or that decisive battle's point of view and into the daily grind of soldiering, right? Looking past pitched battles and the violence that we focus on in trauma. We focus so much in trauma about on this question of killing, and we don't focus enough about, and we don't listen to soldiers enough, because when soldiers complain, they complain about low rations, they complain about poor clothing, they complain about atrocity. They don't, like, in the descriptions that I read, the combat descriptions are very stoic, they're very direct, they're almost celebratory. Right, the violence of combat is something that they actually want to experience. That's why they're in these armies. The experience of atrocity and being put into a state of nature, like Native Americans, now that is emotionally damaging. Right, so these are people who, like a prisoner, like Thomas Sidney Jessup, is going to describe being wounded at the battles of Lundy's Lane, as if I was standing up and suddenly I was unconscious, and everybody around me thought I was dead, and then I just woke up and was alive, and I kept kicking and fighting. Matter of fact, no emotional language whatsoever. There is some shifting to third and first person that is, you know, to me as a trauma guy is telling, but no, not the sort of emotional language that he's going to describe receiving prisoners in Fort Harrison and the privation that they've experienced in their captivity. The same is true for a prisoner account of Adam Walker, who will describe the violence of Tippecanoe. He will describe Native Americans as human and their screams as wounded as human in ways that differentiate from other writers. But to be wounded or engage in direct combat is something that he's describing in the most disconnected, unemotional language that you would. And it's almost, again, it's almost, they're proud of this. They wanted to do this. Whereas when he's a prisoner and he's being shamed by the British Army as one of Hull's exterminators, and has low rations, and people are dying of privation in his regiment that survived combat, that is when he's going to resort to emotional language. So this differentiation in trauma, where we really want to ask veterans about what it's like to kill people, and I don't think that's what they want to talk about. I think they want to talk about, you know, eating hardtack all the time. I think they want to talk about what it's like to invade Canada, right, which is the worst place in the world that you can invade, because the only time you can go up there is when it's malarial season. So the only time you can really fight in these campaigns are in these really harsh frontier settings where you're in a war more against nature and your enemy, and the nature is really what's divining and affecting. And, you know, psychologists used to study weather as a thing that creates mental disorders. It's kind of fallen out of favor, and to a degree we do it with major weather events like hurricanes, but weather was something that people feared a great deal. The other thing about this was, in reading these accounts, privation is significant and complained about, and this transition from being a civilized person who eats a civilized diet and, you know, gets to live in shelter, and then going into this uncivilized environment when you're eating the same thing natives are eating, you're eating in big gluts of food, and then instead of, you know, steady meals, and you're having to quarter and get your own food. And if you have a rich, if you happen to have a rich officer like Winfield Scott, he's going to buy you stuff. But most people don't, so they have to forage. And the British are essentially, in American prisoners' minds, taking taking the means of even going out and getting your own food off of farmers and things like that. They're even taking those means away and starving these people to death. And you know, to look at that from a way that psychologists do, when they look at when we look at low social economic status and hunger and deprivation and things like that, it really is damaging for somebody mentally. And we don't like when we focus on war trauma from combat, we really lose the other negative emotional experiences that people have and the things that they complain about the most. The other key aspect of these experiences were this heightened fear of tribal atrocity, right? And like somebody like Louis Bond to me is the most significant because at the beginning of his memoir, before he's a captive, right, he's very even-handed in his descriptions of Native Americans, right? He's one of the only accounts who describes Hull's Northwest Army out in the Detroit area as this plundering, exterminating force that is out like making enemies out of local villages until he's captured. And he has this cultural fear of atrocity and being in a position where he can't defend himself. So to a degree, the thing that tends to be the most frightening for these prisoners is not the regularity of atrocity, it's actually the unpredictableness of it. It's not happening all the time. So anytime you're captive of Native Americans and they start drinking, or you're just drinking alcohol, or they get into any sort of every emotional experience, every time that you think they might be getting upset with you is a moment where somebody might kill you. The other thing about this whole situation with Native Americans that that I argue in my paper is that because of this cultural idea that I'm not convinced tells us a lot about Native Americans, and this isn't a work about Native Americans, this is a work about prisoners. It tells us a lot more about fear of Native Americans, but it also provides a unique window into trauma. Because again, are these people traumatized by combat? Probably. Like, that's not something I could ever prove, because it's not something somebody would have recorded, right? Will they talk about trauma and emotional language when they're prisoners, especially prisoners of Native Americans? Yes. That is a cultural means that will be published and read, right? That those, there are other, like, if you were going to write a horror of war manuscript in the War of 1812, no one would have read it. It wouldn't, you know, like, that is not something that had an audience, whereas these descriptions of the brutality of Native Americans do offer a cultural audience. It is stories that people want to hear. There is this tradition that scholars better than me, like Linda Colley, have really outlined as really fundamental to this experience. Now, some of the things that as I close this work, one of the things that would strike me about the difference between, say, 1812 literature about sort of traumatic experience and captivity that is different today, and I think in some ways is better, is this notion that, like, this fundamental notion that we can't understand traumatic and warfare experience unless we also experience it. I think that's a really powerful idea today. And in these trauma memoirs, there are moments when, like, people who have been in the Continental Army understand this better than others in these memoirs, but most of the time, when they're talking about, you know, seeing the body parts of their friends, right, like these being paraded, when they're talking about, you know, the constant fear of death or the just not going weeks without food and these moments of really sheer emotional terror, they believe that people can understand that. And I think that people can understand it. That is a story that we can all really empathize and understand a person's traumatic event. So there's something different about, like, the thing about studying sickness in the past that I've always struck as a veteran myself is that there's a lot that we can learn about this, and there's a lot that we can, when it's unmediated by, like, diagnoses and, like, the sort of, like, culture that we have around today, there's something we can gain from this time when people believe that people who weren't exposed to poor emotional events and war can understand it. Like, that's not quite out in the draft that I have now. It's really where I want to see this paper move is looking at, you know, how to create these sort of cultural windows where we are listening to experience, because I think that this process of storytelling is valuable. The other thing is the striking language that I'll just sort of conclude it. Striking language that is so parallel. I mean, and I think, like, I want to bring up, and I hate to bring up a political cartoon because I don't like doing that in public settings, but it just gives you a parallel between, and I'm referring to the political cartoon with the POW for the Hillary Clinton campaign, where, you know, they're talking about bad-mouthing POWs, and there's an event where he said, you know, this happened to me 40 years ago, and it happened to me yesterday. And now I'm going to read William Atherton's description of his experiences as a prisoner. Though many years have rolled by since events transpired, the impression they made upon my mind is almost as fresh as ever. He doesn't really have any descriptions of combat. He has a lot of descriptions of trauma, and he uses the same language that we would use today. And a lot of these authors are as capable of writing in the traumatic language that is typically identified as something that's in the 20th century, as we would say today. Soldiers didn't often get that voice. This is one of the few times where people wanted to listen to soldiers about that. And it's a window that is important for today in terms of our understanding of it, but also to give us a better description of what combat and soldiering was like in the early Republic. Thank you.
Well, this morning I was getting dressed and I said, oh, obviously I have to wear heels. And Chris was like, most girls don't own heels. I was like, I won't be able to see if I don't wear heels. So we're wearing heels. Well, good morning, everyone. Thank you to Joe for opening us with that fantastic discussion of trauma. Obviously, I'm working on captivity narratives, and the idea of captivity narratives as a conduit, as expressions of trauma in War of 1812 is just fantastic. And also thank you to Leanne and Dan and Lorian for hosting this magnificent conference. I hope that we're living up to your expectations, because you obviously have. So thank you. And I'm going to keep on with the kind of the depressing note of the morning and be talking about Confederate ex-prisoners of war. So in recent years, historians of the American Civil War have increasingly explored the ways in which white and black veterans of the Union Confederate armies re-entered civilian life, participated in veteran organizations, and how post-Civil War society regarded them after their return home. Yet, prisoners of war, especially ex-Confederates, remain largely absent from this scholarship. Despite a plethora of post-war accounts, only a few historians have examined these writings using a memory studies approach. And many of those focus on Union ex-prisoners, which I know Doug will do. In an attempt to fill the void, this paper analyzes the ways in which Confederate ex-prisoners of war discussed their captivity between 1865 and 1890. So during Reconstruction, ex-Confederates faced several obstacles when attempting to commemorate their wartime experiences. Most federal authorities censored all forms of Confederate memorialization. In this period of bitterness, which was intensified by stories of Union soldiers dying of starvation in Southern prisons, seemingly harmless actions of placing flowers on a grave provoked strong reactions from the federal government. Moreover, the constant recitation of Confederate prison abuses, augmented by the humiliation defeat, further eclipsed the few Southern voices of dissent that protested the North's selective memory of Civil War prisons. But with the end of Reconstruction, ex-Confederates were given the opportunity to share their stories. Just as Northerners attacked Confederate prison administrators, Southerners likewise accused the federal government of mistreating Confederate prisoners. Hoping to turn the tide, or at least share the blame, Confederate ex-prisoners shared their captivity narratives with the public. Comparing their experiences to those written by Andersonville survivors, Confederate ex-prisoners pointed to the appalling mortality rates in northern prisons and argued that their federal captors deliberately mistreated them by denying food, clothing, shelter, and medical care. According to those who survived northern prisons, they suffered just as much as any Yankee prisoner of war. By sharing their memories, Confederate ex-prisoners not only attempted to commemorate their dead comrades, but also to provide what they believed to be the correct history of Civil War prisons. Although accounts of captivity in the North are far less numerous, Confederate ex-prisoners were not to be outdone and published their stories as well. Their works not only celebrated Confederate unity and the righteousness of the Confederate cause, but also stressed the lethality of Union prisons. Confederate ex-prisoners claimed to have it as bad as any Union prisoner of war, employing language and themes similar to that of early Republicans' attacks on the Southern prison system. Confederate ex-prisoners declared that they endured exposure, poor rations, and disease in Northern prisons. Ex-Confederates also wanted to be remembered for their heroism and sacrifice. During Reconstruction, ex-Confederates remained relatively silent about their war experiences. While this retinous was not what historian Gerald Linderman describes as the hibernation, many ex-Confederates did not readily share their stories until the late 1870s. Those who did publish their captivity narratives during Reconstruction refuted condemnations of the South's prison system by highlighting their suffering in Union prisons. Then, with the removal of federal troops and the establishment of the Southern Historical Society, ex-Confederates gained new venues to share their interpretations of the war and commemorate its cause of Southern independence, which was rooted in white supremacy and racial oppression. As part of this literary surge, survivors of Northern prisons published their accounts and depicted themselves as worthy subjects of remembrance. Similar to Union ex-prisoners, ex-Confederates identified themselves as victims of a brutal enemy, and they too deserved to be recognized for their wartime sacrifices. Along with identifying as victims of a cruel federal government in post-war captivity narratives, Confederate ex-prisoners also stressed the need to restore white supremacy. Writing in the post-emancipation South, white Southerners, not surprisingly, continued to regard blacks as lesser beings and sought to relegate blacks to their pre-war servile status. In their narratives, former prisoners frequently wrote of savage African-American guards and insolent freed people. Walter Addison, for instance, reported that the black troops at Point Lookout were infamously cruel. In many instances, he contended, they conducted themselves in a savage manner, as they would shoot innocent prisoners for no reason. Even worse was the charge that federal officers tolerated such activity. Addison additionally claimed that Union officers ordered the African-American guards to shoot any prisoner out past 8 o'clock at night, which was an order not shared with the prisoners. This led to the death of many prisoners. Joe Barbier and others confirmed Addison's allegations, and they too argued that African-American guards perpetrated many of the attacks. Those held on Morris Island also insulted their African-American guards, portraying them as either savages or comical characters. John Dunkel recurrently mocked the colored gentlemen who were in charge of guarding the prisoners, and I've deleted some of the very offensive quotes from this paper because I didn't feel comfortable saying them, but I do have a few. According to Dunkel, the federal officers were utterly devoid of principle, truth, and honor, and the privates betrayed all the ignorance, villainy, and cruelty peculiar to barbarians. He claimed that the guards only came in to call the prisoners liars and other epithets, quote, which could be used in their fiercest sense by brutal and ignorant Negroes. White Southerners feared and despised African-American soldiers because blacks in uniform shattered the ideal notion of the submissive slave. And ex-prisoners' captivity narratives reflect this fear and resentment. Along with undermining the worthiness of African-Americans, ex-prisoners shared stories of brutality in an effort to undermine federal government policy and memory of retaliation. After being bombarded with atrocity stories beginning in the summer of 1864, federal officials initiated a retaliation program in which they withheld food and medicine to inflict similar treatment on Confederates that Union prisoners were believed to be receiving. After the war, Northerners, including Union ex-prisoners, commended retaliation as the proper response to Confederate cruelty. Unsurprisingly, Confederate prisoners rejected the federal government's justifications for retaliation. According to those who published their memoirs, the new policy only brought unnecessary suffering and death. By portraying themselves as victims of a cruel enemy government, Confederate ex-prisoners commemorated their dead comrades and challenged the Norse history of the Civil War prisons. This constructed identity of victimhood took its place in the growing Lost Cause pantheon, which sought to explain Confederate defeat as well as reinforce the righteousness of the Confederate cause. David Blight notes, many Lost Cause writers and activists during the Reconciliationist era were not at all shy of arguing about the causes of the war. Bewildered by the collapse of the Confederacy and looking toward an uncertain future, white Southerners mounted a rhetorical campaign to honor dead prisoners and exonerate themselves from Northern accusations. Nina Silber further elucidates that through this process, Southerners over time constructed a rationale for secession and the war's objectives. The use of Lost Cause rhetoric distinguishes Confederate post-war narratives from those written during the war and those written by Northerners. As part of the Lost Cause, ex-Confederates portrayed themselves as brave warriors in an honorable but hopeless effort to defend a noble society. Key to Lost Cause ideology is the belief that the Confederacy was doomed to lose to Union overwhelming resources and industrial strength. Ex-prisoners promulgated this belief by discussing the immensity, abundance, and power of the enemy. Westwood Todd wrote in 1888, that when he saw the North's immense army trains drawn by powerful, well-kept horses and mules, in fact, their splendid equipment in every department, he drew considerable consolation from the reflection that we have achieved so much against such a vastly superior forces. Todd remarked that he could not imagine that the capture of 7,000 men could even tax the federal commissary. R.M. Gray even argued that the North was so well supplied because they received help from European nations, further dooming the Confederacy's attempt at independence. By the 1890s, the emphasis on the righteousness of the Southern cause also permeated ex-prisoners' narratives. When educating his son on the war's history, R.M. Gray stated that Southerners felt outraged in person, despoiled of property, denied equal rights in common territory of the nation, and the election of Abraham Lincoln, who he describes as the leader of Northern despotism, forced Southerners to protect themselves. He denied what he believed to be Northern interpretation of the war, that a few ambitious men dragged all Southerners into it. Moreover, he informed his son that their cause was equal to that of the Founding Fathers. But unlike the Founding Fathers who won against the British in that unequal conflict, Southerners lost their own unequal conflict. Yet division and failure did not result in their defeat, as the official history recorded. Rather, the Union overwhelmed the honorable Confederates. By the early 19th century, according to David Moon, Southern Baptists had become experts at performing the rituals and speaking the language of liberty and martial manhood. So it is not surprising, then, that Confederates linked their struggle to that of the Founding Fathers. At commemorative events across the South, orators compared the Confederate cause to the American Revolution, reaffirming the centrality of honor to male culture. Ex-prisoners writing in the 1870s and 1880s continued to incorporate comparisons to the American Revolution in their writings, just as they did during the war. Within the emerging Lost Cause, ex-Confederates depicted Unionists, deserters, and oath-takers as inferior, marginal individuals. Although wartime diaries and letters disclosed that hundreds of men took the oath of allegiance, ex-prisoners maintained that only a handful of the most desperate men took the oath. In all, we know that over 6,000 Confederate soldiers took the oath of allegiance and switched sides during the war, which Dr. Hess talked about yesterday. These men, officially known as the U.S. Volunteers, were formed into 6 regiments and were commonly referred to as galvanized Yankees. The dishonorable act of swearing allegiance to the Union, according to many ex-prisoners, represented a forfeiture of their Southern citizenship and betrayal of the Confederacy. Men willing to abandon the cause and join the enemy were cravens who did not deserve any acknowledgement or sympathy. For some, to enter into any contract with the enemy was unforgivable. R.M. Gray insulted the scoundrel who opened an eating saloon within Camp Chase. The man allegedly deserted from a Georgia regiment, and the Yankees allowed him extra privileges on account of his villainy. Gray contrasted his devotion to the cause of that of the galvanized Yankees. He declared that even when surrounded by disease, He never abandoned his loyalties, and he came out of jail as happy as a man as ever wore Confederate gray. These stories reiterate Southerners' continued loyalty to the Confederacy, even when faced with starvation, disease, and ruin. While ex-prisoners condemned some for faltering loyalty in their post-war accounts, they also expressed pride in those who continued to fight with a calm confidence in the cause, a noble acceptance of sacrifice, an undaunted courage, a patient hope, a chivalric devotion that fearlessly challenged the comparisons of history. Even those Confederates captured shortly before or Lee's surrender explained that they displayed one final motion of resistance when they heard of Lee's surrender, so much so that their federal guards were forced to bring in a howitzer to maintain calm. Ex-Confederates writing the post-war period expressed no regrets for their service. White women also played an important role in ex-prisoners' writings and lost cause ideology. Not only did Confederate women appear as determined, unwavering supporters of their husbands, sons, and fathers, but also beacons of hope for prisoners. Nina Silber clarifies that ex-Confederates fashioned a lost cause mentality that placed white women and Southern domestic life as the center of their thinking. This new rhetoric enabled them to portray the Southern cause as moral, virtuous, and righteous, and slavery as benign domestic arrangements in which slaves contributed to the charming home and family life of the South. As a result, the iconic figures of the Southern lady, the gentleman planter, and the loyal servant slave were cemented into public memory. Ex-prisoners promulgated these idealized images in their post-war accounts. Horresco Austill, for instance, recounted that while traveling to New Orleans, women surrounded him and his fellow prisoners to express their love and sympathy. During one prison memorial service, the author described white women as sympathetic providers using their little pin money and working with their needles to aid suffering Confederate prisoners. Joe Barbier, for instance, dedicated his memoir to a single woman whose kindness to the author while a prisoner of war is yet fresh in his memory. The post-war literature written by Confederate ex-prisoners shaped and crystallized their identity in the post-war South, as well as promulgated the burgeoning lost cause. Contemporary diaries and memoirs from ex-prisoners reveals that Northern prisons were not as horrific as some ex-prisoners portrayed them to be. However, survivors asserted that they were victims of a cruel, inhumane federal government. According to them, they suffered just as much as any Yankee prisoner. Ex-Confederates also used their writings to threaten retribution. R.M. Gray warned his son another time of evil was fast approaching, and it was ex-prisoners' responsibility to share their experiences and tell the true history of the war to prevent such from happening. Many, like Gray, hoped that those who had similar experiences would come forward with the disgraceful scenes that they had witnessed. It was up to survivors to attest to the miserable outrages. By sharing their stories, Confederate ex-prisoners attempted to simultaneously commemorate their dead comrades, promote their collective memory, and absolve the Confederacy of the blame for the deaths of Union prisoners. Ex-Confederates continued to write their memoirs into the 20th century, and some of their interpretations became foundation of the South's history of the war. Beginning in the late 1880s, ex-Confederates, however, began to downplay suffering and highlight shared sacrifice and courage instead. There had been limited attempts at reconciliation before, but gestures towards understanding and forgiveness largely began in the late 1880s. Around the turn of the century, as more Civil War veterans passed away, both Union Confederate ex-prisoners focused on the common sacrifice of the individual, whatever his political affiliation and whatever his cause. Thank you.
I'm going to suspect I'm not going to need the box to stand.
Do you want me to move it?
I presume it just moves it. There you go.
I can pick it up. You can.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I was going to say, can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. This is a beautiful room, but frankly, and I know you weren't the sound engineer, so I'll say this, the acoustics aren't the best necessarily always. You're sitting in the back. I have sort of a run-on subtitle to the paper, Masculinity, Social Class, Westernness, and Food. I spent more hours than it was probably worth trying to figure out what to put in the subtitle, how to order it, and so forth. Hopefully it'll become clear why it's working that way. I'd like to, as everybody has, thank the organizers for organizing this. I know when I saw the call for papers last spring or whenever it was, I thought, gee, that's me, that's interesting. That's an excuse to get out some of the work that I've put away as I've been on a teaching-only line at my university with heavy administrative and service responsibilities. And sometimes I think I'm the only person in the world who cares a damn about Civil War prisoners of war, and or prisoners of war even in general. And, you know, there's about three other people in the country working on it. Well, you know, turns out we have, you know, 15 or 20 here today, and that's great. You always have to start an academic paper by telling an interesting anecdote that you've come across in your research that may or may not be directly relevant, but at least gets you into the topic at hand. In 1876, a book was published with the short title of Opium Eating. It was anonymously published. The author was identified on the title page as an habituate. I'm not going to go through the whole story. I have pages and pages and pages of summary and contextualization and so forth. But the story is of a, whether you believe it to be true or not is a whole other issue. But the story is told in the voice of an ex-prisoner at Andersonville who was starved and had various and sundry insults offered to his body, came home, continued to suffer from what we will politely call digestive after effects of that experience, and eventually was prescribed opiates by a physician on the fairly sound medical theory that opiates do actually have GI consequences and often are, even to this day, sometimes used for those purposes, with the result that he became an addict. Now I have to put on the glasses. An habituate became an opium eater because of his difficulties in eating and digesting and eliminating food. Food, its absence or its presence, supply and distribution, preparation and consumption, has always played a central role in the life of soldiers, especially those being held as prisoners. Examples of food in wartime. Surprisingly little sustained attention has been paid to the role food played in the Civil War. Corruptions in the Union, and there's a lot of topics that seem relevant, corruptions in the Union supply system, the naval blockade, Richmond bread riots, but it's not all been brought together, and it won't be today either. And more generally, and I think this is important, even if I don't play it out in this paper, the mid and late 19th centuries are a period in which people are going to have a different attitude and experience with hunger and with the possibility of hunger, because this is the period of the Hungry 40s and the great Irish potato famine and of urbanization and many other things. And also it's the coming of a national, corporately controlled food supply. There's a lot of things happening with food in the 19th century, and there's a lot of things happening in hunger in the 19th century. Today, those of us who live in developed societies regard hunger as something we see on TV, even though I suspect we can probably walk three blocks from here and find it. I don't think it was that way in the 19th century. It was much more present in people's lives and people's imaginations and people's fears of what, even if they seem to be secure now, might be coming. Food is always a cultural and social product requiring interaction among humans. Those who cannot find enough food, cannot find enough social resources to command adequate amounts of food, will eventually die. We structure community through food, 4th of July, Thanksgiving. Food is important in military organizations, if for no other reason than it structures the day. You know, it provides comradeship among people, soldiers. It's food in Civil War armies is generally prepared in small groups of four, five, six, whatever the case might be, who pool their rations. In Frank Leslie's illustrated newspaper on the 7th of May, 1864, there was a throwaway article that included a woodcut engraving weighing army rations. Complete, okay. Soldiers using a makeshift scale supported on a tripod of rifles to precisely measure out rations. Food is one of the things that is provided by the bureaucratic structures of the war, and one of the things that when food quits being provided, the army falls apart, as witnessed the Confederate Army in the spring of 1865. Okay. Let's go to Andersonville. February 1864, the Confederacy began assembling captured Union soldiers in a makeshift camp at a whistle stop hamlet in southwest Georgia called, actually, Anderson. Even before prisoners arrived, Confederate officers on the scene were voicing concern to Richmond authorities about food supplies and other logistical matters. And indeed, one of the ideas of moving prisoners to Andersonville was to reduce the demand for food in the Richmond area. 30,000 prisoners eventually by the summer, 26-acre enclosure. People start to die. Augustus Choate Hamlin, a Union Army physician, was one of the first Union officials to reach Andersonville in the summer of 1865. Provided the northern public one of the first accounts of what life in the camp had been. As to the arrangement for the distribution of food, Hamlin wrote, there was but little attention paid to system. The prisoners were ordered to array themselves into squads of 290 men, and these squads were then subdivided into three messes. Not only did they not get enough food, but none of these messes appear to have been properly supplied with utensils to receive and distribute their food. It does you no good to have rations you can't cook. John Vautier, ex-prisoner, in his narrative. Half of his fellow captives had diarrhea, and our coarse rations aggravated the disease. Among the older prisoners, scurvy was common. About 5,000 men were helping themselves. They were lying all over the pen, many of them half naked under a burning sun and stinking in their filth. Asa Isham, another ex-prisoner, produced an even more gastrointestinal-centered vision of while taking his reader on a verbal tour of the stockade. Here's a living being who has become so exhausted from exposure that he is unable to arise from the ground, suffering with diarrhea in its last and worst form. He is covered with his own feces, and the description disintegrates from there. I won't give it to you this early in the morning. Which order do I want to read this in? I want today to discuss some of the material that can be deduced around the intersections of the history of food and the Civil War, focusing on the conflict between the raiders and the regulators among the populace at Andersonville in the summer of 1864, a conflict which has much to suggest about class and masculinity and sectionalism and so forth. In Civil War America, Americans have always been interested in prisoners, Elliot Gruner has observed, and interests ranging from the 17th century white captives of Indian groups in New England and elsewhere to the latest yellow ribbon inspiring hostages in a turn of the millennium international hotspot. Wrote that sentence a few years ago. Freedom, captivity, slavery are terms that appear on the same page, if in different columns of a thesaurus. And they and various of their synonyms have always been central of contested concepts in American culture. And I go on and I talk about Andersonville captivity narratives, and I link those to other traditions of captivity narratives in American history, including their contemporary the contemporary form of slave narratives. People who have been captive in some sense, have to get out of their captivity either by their own efforts or in some other way to be redeemed. And this is a theme that keeps coming up here about prisoners of war over the last day and a half. Everybody, you know, keeps saying prisoners have to explain themselves. We have to come up with an explanation for why they were held prisoner, why they suffered as they did. And in this case, we remove the responsibility from the Union prisoner for his fate by saying he suffered on behalf of the cause. He suffered on behalf of keeping the Union together and perhaps of black freedom as well. I also have somebody, I don't know who it was last night, I don't remember, showed on the screen one of the pictures of a living skeleton, the emaciated Civil War prisoner. Most of us in this room, I suspect, regardless of our interest in history, have seen that image. Those are images that actually have a very long and complex history. Many of them are not really of Andersonville prisoners. There are prisoners from Belle Isle and other things. And yeah, Chris is nodding his head back there. And I have pages and pages on that. Of course, if Union soldiers are redeemed by their suffering, that just goes even more to show the evil of the Confederacy, right? Just as it works both ways. The Confederates deliberately starved prisoners, right? Well, no, not really, but that's the story. And it's a story that's told even during wartime. And Angela actually did a very nice job of talking about the rhythm of post-war memory from the Confederate standpoint, that things sort of pick up in prisoner of war narratives from the Southern perspective after about 1880. They're able finally to get themselves organized enough to launch a counterattack. Even the most partisan of Union commentators, how am I doing on time? I could not argue that all the killing at Andersonville was done by the Confederates. Despite the implied claims of comradeship and continued devotion to the cause, even in harsh adversity, it was perhaps inevitable that Andersonville prisoners would turn on each other as they struggled to survive in a place that almost overnight had become Georgia's largest concentration of population. Andersonville was Georgia's largest city in the summer of 1864. The camp had commercial districts. It had a recognized street system. It had regular places of worship. One of the landmarks of the camp was the Masonic Lodge. There were racial and ethnic neighborhoods. It's a 19th century American city, or a parody of one, perhaps. Where resources, including especially food, are insufficient to keep everyone alive, those who do obtain adequate access to food and other goods do so at the expense of others who by definition die, or at least die more quickly. Prisoners who, for whatever reason, better physical and psychological health upon entering Andersonville, the presence of friends and comrades, the possession of a cash or tobacco or a watch, could command more and varied resources over a longer period than others less well endowed were more likely to survive longer. Ovid L. Futch, in his monograph on Andersonville, summarized the difference and food resources commanded by the so-called regulators and the rest of the camp's population. The predators, the raiders, those who take advantage, who band together and try to take advantage of, harass, terrorize the others, enjoyed certain advantages which discouraged resistance. They were better fed, they were better able to resist. I have examples of that. This is a social Darwinian logic. It's a logic we see played out in other prisons in other wars. Some of the Andersonville prisoners tried to improve their odds by banding together. How am I doing on time? I have 3 minutes. I have about 4 minutes of stuff to say, so it sort of works out.
We went under.
The raiders, as they seem to have called themselves, and as they have mostly passed into history, were by all available accounts produced mostly by soldiers from Western states, and entirely by prisoners who shared a devotion to the Union cause and a Protestant middle class culture of respectability. The Raiders seem to have been Eastern, urban, working class, Irish, Irish American, and hence presumably Catholic. The Raiders, foreign-born, papists, generally un-American, rough and tough members of New York urban gangs, at least that's the impression you get from the later narrativists of the incident, banded together. They recalled, we talked about St. Patrick's, the St. Patrick Battalion during the Mexican War, supposedly Irish soldiers who had turned coats and gone over to the Mexican side. John McElroy, a member of the 16th Illinois Cavalry, later became a journalist in Ohio and a veterans advocate, produced probably the best-known account of the Raiders. McElroy's honesty has been called into question, but that's not really important. It's that people read it and believed it that's important for me. The New Yorkers, he calls them. All the arts learned in the prisons in New York were put into exercise. Decoys, bunco steerers at home would be on the lookout for promising subjects who would then be separated from the mass of prisoners and harassed. Asa Isham, a Union prisoner, who's later a prominent member of the Evangelical United Brethren, extensive quote about how these people had lost their souls. By the last week of June, as the Raiders grew in boldness, a group of prisoners from Western states, all Eastern comrades seemed to have been excluded as potential security risks, decided to band together against the depredations. An Illinois soldier named Leroy Key, who I found out is actually buried in the same cemetery as Abraham Lincoln in Springfield, was usually remembered as the driving force behind the Regulators. There also was a leader of the Regulators known as called Ned Corrigan of Chicago, who had once killed a man in a prize fight and was supposedly the toughest man in Andersonville. Key obtained the support of the Commandant, Henry Wirtz, and other prison authorities before seeking to move against the Raiders. Those of you who have seen the movie that was that Turner made, 20, 25 years ago, that's one of the climaxes of the movie. Well, it's a nice movie scene. The Confederate, it couldn't have happened quite that way. The Confederates were, while they were sanctioning this, they also were aiming cannon at the prisoners while all this was going on because they were afraid this was a ruse leading to some sort of mass escape, as would only seem logical. There seems to have been a number of people who may have been killed. They sort of occlude all of this in some of the accounts. But if you read between the lines, there's some people who are sort of killed outright. There is a show trial put on. They're very careful to explain to you that they abided by the principles of lawfulness and good, middle-class, respectable, legalistic culture, and then they hanged them. Wirtz provided lumber for the gallows. Irish Catholic chaplain at Andersonville accompanied the prisoners, almost all of whom had very Irish-sounding names, to the gallows. One of the ropes broke. Ovid Futch says this reflects the shortage of good hemp in the Confederacy. People make conventional gallows speeches and so forth, at least according to the accounts. Last thing I want to say, and this I do not have as written out as I should. We have prisoners who are figuring themselves, at least later on, as white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, Westerners, middle class, who are regulating, who are controlling, who are striking back against other prisoners who are, the way it's being told at least, urban immigrant, children of immigrant, many Irish, many Catholic, who are not capable of behaving as good Americans. Okay. But that still leaves section. Well, A lot of recent work has suggested, and some of this work is yet to be published, that the Civil War and the memory of the Civil War is important in the construction of identity in what is, by the end of the 19th century, going to start to be called the Midwest. And, you know, if people are in the 1880s and 1890s are beginning to talk about this is what we did, this is why we did it, this shows we were good, loyal Westerners, well, that seems to be a step on the way towards a new sort of Western and Midwestern identity. I also, though, tell you, to complicate that story, that I'm involved in something called the Civil War Study Group, which started off as sort of people in central Indiana and has sort of evolved into a Midwestern, including Kentucky, organization that meets once a year and reads papers to each other. I'm in the last paragraph. Reads papers to each other and so forth. And a lot of the scholars are centered in Indiana, are working on Indiana topics. And while, you know, Indiana is a good Western state and provides many good regulators and so forth, it's also a state, if you believe many of the works that have recently been published or are about to be published, that is very terribly divided during the Civil War, perhaps the most divided of all the northern states, aside from if you want to count Missouri as a border state or something like that, which is its own special thing. So I think we need to pay attention to social differences, sectional differences, as we look at Civil War veterans and how they understand and present their experiences. Thank you.
Well, thank you, everybody, for excellent papers here. And I'm inviting again. We have enough time for discussion and questions, so fire away. Will first, and then you, sir.
Question for Angela. So, that was excellent.
Oh, thank you.
But you were talking about the Confederate post-war narratives are used in memory studies.
That's a great question. It's kind of the who cares, why should we care question. So I'm not going to say this is all made up, right? There's definitely embellishments and exaggerations. But some of these individuals truly believe that their story is not going to be remembered, that they are going to be lost to history, the victors are going to write the history, they're only going to know what the North says about the Confederacy, and they're afraid that their story is going to be lost. And so there is a group that, yes, it's very much rooted in white supremacy, but some of them are just, no, I want to be remembered, I want my buddies to be remembered who died. So they died because rations were cut, they died because of the cold weather, and they don't want to be lost after they pass away. So I think that's the importance, is just honoring these guys, because many of these guys truly believe that they are going to be forgotten. And they, you have to remember, although they were fighting for the Confederacy and they were fighting against the United States of America, they are still Americans and they were fighting for a cause, and I kind of buy into that. You know, we owe that to them, to remember them if we can, just as much as we would remember a Union POW. You know, and then even, I ended at 1890, but starting in 1890 to 1930, and I end at 1930 because so many guys die that there's not many narratives left after 1930. I think I have two, 1931 and then 1937. They actually do switch. Union and Confederate POWs collectively kind of switch to this idea of the shared sacrifice, saying, yeah, like maybe we should remember each other. Because guess what? We both lost guys. We both suffered, you know? We all deserve to be remembered. And there is a collective shift the last 40 years of their lives to more collective memory of heroism and sacrifice. Not saying they're not outliers or liars and people who are just trying to make profit, et cetera, but I think we do have to remember the guys who did fight and they suffered for a cause. No, thank you for your question.
Sir?
So regarding female prisoners, we do have a handful who are
mixed in,
but not known to be female. So you know what I mean? Like the fun stories of the woman dressing up as a Union soldier to fight because her brother died, or there are, you know, the extreme fun stories of the one or two women. However, no actual known women are going to be in Andersonville or Elmira. You want to speak to it? Like, yeah. Known women.
There is.
Well, it was not expected to start out with that there would be female prisoners of war or that civilians would be involved.
That's what I mean. Like,
so what happens is they establish separate.
Yeah, that's what I was getting to it. No, I was getting to it. Yeah. No, I was getting to, like, eventually they do have the separate.
By, like, 1863.
Yeah. So starting out, no, but.
Hang on.
Yes.
Yeah, guys, thank you. I was getting there, but I really appreciate you all jumping in. I love this having this roundtable discussion. But yeah, I was getting there. But yes, they've answered your question. When they do find them, they do separate them, and then we're also going to have them putting in like civilian jails and prisons. And I think Angie has something to say. Women. Yep.
Michael, on that topic? Okay.
Wasn't there a woman who accompanied her husband to Libby or something and gave birth at Libby? Does that ring a bell with anybody else in the room? Thank you.
Beth knows about it.
Okay, Leanne first, and then Lorian, and then you, ma'am.
No, I assume that he was talking about the military base.
This whole discussion of women prisoners of war is missing the experience of most women who are prisoners of war, which is not in fact in the formal military prison.
Like, for instance, like Sherman, he takes over somewhere in North Georgia, and he takes, I think, 50-some women, and like the youngest is 12, and he ships them on the railroad up to Tennessee. It's like, and he like takes them as prisoners of war. They're not as combatants, but they're supporting the Confederacy, and he decides to ship them.
I was very interested in these female military prisons, and so I went to the National Archives thinking that there would be records of female military prisons, and in fact, there are no records. According to the 30-year expert who has been in the National Archives and specialized in Civil War military records since forever, and they handed me on to him, and I said, I'm interested in the female military prisons. He goes,
what?
And not surprisingly, we can't, although the military have almost every, I mean, they have huge, vast Civil War military records, but there are no, that anyone knows about, formal military records from these female military prisons, because no one wanted to admit that they actually existed, and they created them by default, because they didn't expect it was going to be such a hard war.
Sherman did.
Well, Well, just take your next 20 lifetimes and go through the 1,500 boxes and find and find the material. Yeah, I mean.
I think they just got
lost. Lorian?
They were definitely in Andersonville. And then we were just talking about Camp Chase this morning with some black Confederates in Camp Chase. They weren't segregated in Camp Chase, right? They stayed with their masters. I'm asking Chris because he knows more about the Camp Chase. But there is going to be African-American soldiers in Andersonville. But there's such a small number because guess what? Many of them are killed upon capture or reintroduced to slavery even if they were never slaves. Hence, we do have the end of the exchange then, because Lincoln goes, hey, they're soldiers. You have to treat them like soldiers. And the Confederacy's like, no, they're not. So there is not many that go to Andersonville. And then there's extreme abuse then of them in Andersonville, not surprisingly. And then Chris, I know, knows about, I'm totally calling Chris out, but about the black Confederates who are manservants of Confederate soldiers who are captured in Fort Donelson and sent to Camp Chase. I'm going to let him talk.
Yes. Is that right on there? Because I saw you had your hand up, too. Is that right on that topic?
This is the best thing about this then, conference, guys, is that we all know something, and we can all share it. So. Yeah.
Okay, then Chris first, and then I get to you, ma'am. Sorry about that.
Used as laborers.
Yeah,
yep.
Used as laborers. There are a few that are captured at Alusky that end up at Andersonville. Now, of course, from the other side of that, one of the conundrums that the U.S. Army Force could deal with in some pretty early in the war, when the Dugout came out and Mike's coming out here, is they're capturing the black body soldiers early in the war, and that's forcing the U.S. Army to go, what's our policy on slavery here? We've got to come up with a policy. So, to answer your question, yes, they are actually, interestingly enough, they are integrated. Andersonville is the first integrated national cemetery. Black prisoners are buried right next to white prisoners, which is, I think, is really fascinating. I was always talking about that on the cemetery.
So there are there. There's just not many of them.
Can you speak up, ma'am?
They're the same thing.
Where did the phrase "the war between the states" come into the literature? When did that start?
I actually don't know that answer. The etymology of war between.
I'm going to guess.
Original term?
Yeah, I knew this once. I'm going to guess, and somebody in the room will correct me. I'm sure it's later. That it's more of the. As we get later on in the memory of the war, as we get towards the creation of the Lost Cause mythology and the Confederates, the ex-Confederates striking back at Northern created memories and so forth, that it's a post hoc, after the war, after Reconstruction even, thing.
But I mean, do you think we're talking about the 1890s or the
1930s? I think we're talking, I think we're starting in the 90s and going on beyond that, or the 80s.
I don't know if you've been away yet.
Yeah, it's a I think you're looking at 20th century. I'm just looking at an engram here because I remember seeing this. And it's looking like 1920s. You see it starts spiking, really spiking in 1940.
It's not even during Reconstruction.
No, it's not during
right.
Reconstruction at all. There would be a variety of different terms, like those that are under Reconstruction, the conflict that we wish was still going on. It's much later. Part of this sort of retroactive legalization of the Confederacy of memory that you still see in the Lost Cause, where it's not a rebellion, it's a war. And the Confederacy, the secession was legal, because if secession wasn't legal, we're going to have to call Confederate the keyword. We don't want to have to call them traitors, because they did it. And so, don't have, you can get rid of the treason if it's the war between the states. It's now a legal conflict.
I had a question from a gentleman in the back there. Other questions? Cole?
So my question has nothing to do with the Civil War.
Woo!
As an early American, I have to ask a question.
Is there
about early Americans?
Is there another one?
So it strikes me that these narratives, these captivity narratives that we've read, talking about the trauma of Native American captivity and that fear of atrocity, plays into a sort of trope about Native American
absolutely.
Captivity that goes back to American.
Oh,
culture,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
It's
no question. Yeah, it's definitely more in the paper.
So my question then is, during my period of the Revolution, what you see is revolutionary patriot authors using that trope of Native American captivity to tie the British and Hessians as part of this barbarians. That they sort of, they've sunk to the level of savages, and we are the persecuted, righteous, true Englishmen, true civilized people, and actually do you see that in the War of 1812?
Absolutely. It's a little different, though. Like, and it's one of those subtle points in the paper that I might not have covered as well, kind of going off the cuff. But there's less blame for Native Americans' atrocities. There really is. There's less blame. Native Americans, usually racially, if we call it racially, I don't know if it, until we have social Darwinism, I don't know if that's a good term, personally. But let's use it. But because it's easier. But so they live in a state of nature, so whatever savagery or whatever like is understandable, right? Like that sort of like thing. The British, however, are exploiting this. Like when William Atherton recovers a shell that was used and turns it into a cook stove so it can make something, a Native American takes that from him because of a terrible British officer, right? The every one of these atrocities, which to me, like, because when Americans look at the, like, I haven't been able to figure it out because nobody's ever going to say anything explicitly, but my take is Native Americans don't look at U.S. Army people and the militia as an undifferentiated mass. So when an officer does some terrible stuff to Native Americans and then they capture said officer, they murder him, like, in retaliation. That's not, like, Americans see Native Americans as as one mass. So they're not like, that person recognized this person's committing atrocities and doing awful things and they kill them. So it's random to them? Or it's not random. I don't believe it's random at all. I believe it does happen, but it happens because of what they do. But it's almost always like, the British are using these Native Americans to wash their hands of it. They're directing it. It's a little different, right? Like, they're not savage themselves. They're getting some distance. And the British, like, I think exploit this. Because in every sort of surrender request that they have in the war, they're like, a group of Native Americans are with me that I cannot control their actions in a siege. And, like, some scholars want to say, like, you know, Americans and the British and Europeans on the continent are trying to, you know, emulate the tribal way of war. I'm not convinced. I think they're bringing that old siege mentality into it, of that old siege warfare, where, like, if you oppose me in a siege, nothing's, you know, like, I won't restrain myself. But they're using the legality, like, they're not, Native Americans aren't subject to UCMJ, right? Like, you're not going to have a trial about this. They're using the sort of gray space of Native Americans against them. So they are doing this to a bit. I believe they're doing some of this, but for the Americans, they are the ones pulling the string. They are the source of these atrocities. They're the ones who are making it happen. So it's more directive than, say, dirtying himself with it.
If I could jump in on that, just because we're with the question by Cole and Joe's answer, when I'm looking at your paper and Angela's paper, what I'm seeing here, and I'm, this is just an invitation for a comment, and is establishing in these POW narratives a way of understanding who is and who is not a member of American society. And in your case in particular, Joe, I also saw literally the establishing of borders. This is us, the United States, versus British America, i.e. Canada. So that's what I got, and I was wondering if you could expand on that a little bit, that these narratives tell us in the way they are constructed and told. I know you stressed trauma, but what I read is more about membership and borders than anything. So I
think that, like, in my broader work, I mean, our approach at Maine is a borderlands approach, and one of the things that I'm doing that's a lot different than what we do is I'm kind of trying to dismiss this smuggler paradigm and the New England, New Brunswick, the New England and the Maritimes argument that this is a war that is prone to, like, these open borders, whereas for soldiers, I believe that this really defines the border. And this is a war fought by New Englanders, by the way, the war up there, like, there are a couple of Southern regiments, but Southerners are busy in the South hoping that they don't have a slave revolt. This is a war fought by the states who don't really want to fight it as much, like the people who are opposed to it. So that sense of the border and these, like, terrible traumatic experience and privation in general, so not in this paper, not in the prison narrative. This is a theme that definitely is in other papers that build into a dissertation, is that that privation, while watching smugglers supply the British, their countrymen, their state, like Maine, Massachusetts, well, Maine is going to become a thing afterwards. They're still calling it Maine then, though. The District of Maine, these sort of Vermont and places like that, are smuggling in the supplies to the British Army while these armies are, well, these American armies and these American prisoners are just suffering egregious, like, supply issues. And it really, for them, solidifies the border and solidifies what they are. So for some people in the War of 1812, this border isn't meaningful. They want continuous trade. But for soldiers, it is. And the conflict between that more common story of this permeable border is very present. So, yeah.
Yeah, because in your paper, Angela, I saw the border, you know, the racial borders. That's what I'm seeing in your paper, and you made it pretty clear, but I was wondering if you had further comments on that, because what I saw is these POW narratives establish, you know, this is us and we're white. And this is the rest of society that is not white.
Yeah, I think it's also more complicated than that, of course. It's just who deserves remembrance and who doesn't. And so that's why I threw a little bit of the women and also the oath takers in there, because by 1890, there is a division of who deserves it and who doesn't. And African Americans, the guards are talking about, no one has a name. They're essentialized into the evil African American guard. Yeah. So any African American guard, the freed people they see that are being silly and ridiculous outside Johnson's Island, they don't belong. And so then you could translate that to every African American in the South doesn't belong in this new history of the war. Mm-hmm. And then they do the same thing with oath takers, which we know a huge number took the oath or took some sort of made some sort of contract, but they centralized them to a few, and then you ignore the rest. So who's worthy and who's not? So it's very important how they're going to construct the post-war South and how they're going to move forward, and it's all about that identity construction, that memory construction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this one's, I guess, mostly for Angela, but I'd like to the other two as well.
it obviously becomes a support of the reconciliationist memory of the war, which is in part a support for the lost cause interpretation of the war. I presume you and I would regard that as a negative. Is that the question?
I mean, yeah, essentially, but I want to know specifically how the prisons play, continues to play a role, not just the lost cause as a whole, but the specific prison aspects of it as they appear today.
Everybody suffered. Nobody is to blame. Therefore, we can see the war as having been shared sacrifice among whites of many descriptions, out of which there was a new birth of freedom. However, as we've said many times, you know, by the 1880s, 1890s, you know, we not only are, you know, essentializing people into just being the black prison guard, we're just losing track of blacks altogether. We're losing track of the controversies about, you know, treatment either promised or actually carried out in the field, and those are sometimes very different things, of black troops and, you know, of black prisoners of war. You know, that just all goes away in white America and doesn't come back until the last generation, you know, people in this room have contributed to that, and others as well, and many others as well.
And I'm going to push back a little bit about something. Oh, Joe, do you want to say something?
I'm just saying.
Oh, that. I was like, something also is, so we do have this reconciliation narrative, but you have to also remember that Helmyra is still used. Mm-hmm. You know, Southerners still remember Helmyra, Camp Douglas, right? So, yes, there is a reconciliation movement. You have to remember that Southerners still identify with that the North lied to us, right? Adam, I know why you did this, but we went to this wonderful UDC museum in Charleston, and I got this book about the lies Northerners tell us about, like, Civil War prisons. And it says, like, Helmyra, Camp Douglas, Camp Morton, these Point Lookout. And it's like, you, maybe a more educated Southerner, or, like, there's Northerners who maybe not know who Andersonville is. I have a classroom of students that could tell you that they don't know what it is. Mm-hmm. But they know these stories, right? They've been handed down about the atrocities that their families experienced during the Civil War. So, yeah, there is a reconciliation movement that's also part of Southern identity. And I think, especially with a lot of the conversations we're having now about bringing down Confederate monuments and such, people say, well, why don't you bring down, you know, the Grant Monument or the Sherman Monument? They did awful things too. Like, there's always going to be that pushback because it's part of their identity as well.
People talk out of both sides of their mouth, though. You face one way and you say reconciliation, we all shared together, but you turn the other way and talk to an exclusively, let's say, Southern crowd, and you say, you know, our suffering was equal, but ours was more equal than theirs.
No. Sir, first, and then Will.
Well, I do have. So, like, memory and history today of the War of 1812 is still kind of locked memory and discussion of the War of 1812 is sort of a crude thing to say, but it's still locked in a sort of like a he started it debate. No, it really is. Like, you get the Eastern Michigan, like, Lansing crowd, or like, Native Americans were massacring us and blah, 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 and that's the reason why we were brutal when we bought York. And then Canadians, like going to Canada, doing a lot of research, and having a partner who does it. She did, like, an American study in Canada with the Canadian State Department, and they were, like, very clear, like, we only burnt Washington after you burnt York. There's still this, like, he started it. This is a brutal war, and this is a brutal, like, the 4th Infantry Regiment after the Battle of Brownstown had scalps on their bayonets as they walked. That's a regular infantry regiment had scalps on their bayonets as they walked into Fort Detroit. This is like, that's a whole other paper in my dissertation, so I didn't get into it here. But we got to get out of this he started it debate about the War of 1812 and accept that that debate is why it even happened. That reciprocity is why this notion of retaliation is why it was so brutal, why Washington is burned, why York is burned. And when you get into that, like, they did it, I'm going to retaliate it game, that's how you, like, and frankly, I'm a pariah for saying things like that in the War of 1812 community. I'm periodically ambushed by War of 1812 scholars just by saying, like, we need to be even-handed and tell truth about atrocity and brutality and not try to assign blame, right? Like, to try to understand it and even, like, looking at this as a reciprocal process is very unpopular because, you know, you have Canadians who believe in this peaceable kingdom and you have this sort of, like, I don't know, there's still a field that looks at the writings of white participants in the war about Native Americans uncritically. Like, they look at it, I hope I'm even-handed about it and am apprehensive about it. They're looking at it as fact that still exists. You can still find websites at universities that will really have this cavalcade of, like, have this elevation of these racist, like, look it up. Go to East Michigan's War of 1812 website. It'll make you mad. It should make you mad. And we've got to change this, like, this poor he did it mentality and get into the reciprocity creates atrocity. So.
Sir? Leanne?
So I would be interested in your read of the current debate over Civil War monuments. Like, do you see that as a, like, he said, she said? Is that what's going on here? Are we doing that again?
I don't know. To a degree, I think it's not the same thing because, a lot of those monuments are blatantly, like, 20th century, and they're blatantly a response to segregation, and it's this whole other thing, right? Like, it's like this reemergence, and to that degree, I mean, there are Confederate monuments in Maine, by the way. There's an emergence of the Confederate flag in Maine, and it's just like, what? Because it's this rural culture, and we don't, as scholars, really understand it up there. So I don't know. It's got baggage, and I read a lot of Civil War history, and I teach it, you know, in American surveys. I read it because the methodology is good, and I really steal a lot of it for my work. Not steal, but, you know, I use models that are really popular in the Civil War. I don't know, though. I mean, I think to a degree it's, how do we remember this event in a way that gives, it's like slavery. We want to pass on our genocides. We want to pass, like, it. As historians, we want to pass on all the awful things that we did, and we want to, like, gloss it over. So I don't know how to handle that. I don't know if it's he said, she said, or they started. But could you guys speak to that?
That's a Pandora's box. Yeah.
Yeah.
One last question, and then we're gonna have our coffee break. So last question, please.
We can talk about it later, though.
Yeah.
Well, in that sense, yeah. I mean, just as a non-Civil War historian, the one thing that I try to teach my students, at least, is that history is not just honoring and memorializing. Yep. There's a bit of a difference, and we have to keep that in mind. But thank you for great papers here. Enjoy your coffee break. Oh, Will, did you have a last very quick one?
Yep. Yeah, there are a few.
There are.
Yep, no, we have pensions.
There are pensions.
Thanks, Will.
All right, enjoy your coffee. Thank you.